Welcome to the Mind Your Brain podcast, where I bring you inside the mind of the best athletes in the world, so you can understand the mental secrets of their success. My guest today is Bruckner Chase, former pro triathlete, professional endurance waterman, and ocean advocate. He has completed multiple ultra-distance swim and paddles in the most extreme conditions you can think about. This man is simply exceptional, and what he has accomplished is absolutely mind-blowing. He's also a mindfulness expert, and I am so excited to share this episode with you, where we dive deep and personal into Bruckner's mind. All right, Bruckner, thank you very much for being with me today. And I'm really excited because, first of all, we have a lot in common. We both love the ocean. We both are athletes. And there is a lot of things that I want to talk about around this space. It has been actually quite hard to find the right time to do this podcast with you because you are like such a busy person. You are involved in so many things, and that's actually one part that really fascinates me, is how you can actually organize your mind to deal with so many projects. Right. I mean, very quickly about you. So you started as a pro triathlete, then you moved into endurance sport. You've been doing a lot of like long distance swimming, long distance running. I didn't find a lot of stuff about long distance cycling, so I take it you are more like a swimmer and a runner.
Yeah, ironically though, I did Ironman distance triathlon. So, you know, triathletes tend to kind of gravitate to the distance side of cycling and swimming and running as well. Yeah. And I actually worked in the bike industry for almost 2 decades.
Oh, did you? Okay.
Yes, I was the director of construction and store development for a major U.S. retailer in the cycling world. So I was very embedded in cycling, but I remember working with people that were doing some of the 24-hour races, you know, the 24 hours of Canaan for the mountain bikers and some of the really ultra distance cycling. I just never got into that. I mean, I progressed from competing in triathlons as a professional, like you said, really early on. I mean, in the late 80s and early 90s. Mm-hmm. And as triathlons became more structured, I felt I needed more adventure and kind of moved from triathlons, found my next niche was in ultra distance running and did some 50 and 100 mile runs. I enjoyed the adventure of it. I enjoyed the solve problems on your own out in the middle of nowhere in the middle of the night sort of stuff. So, you know, it was not much of a switch from kind of this pursuit of originally, and this kind of will go towards what we're talking about, the mindset. And I did my first really long run when I was young and actually living in Australia. And I finished this marathon and it wasn't anything that I thought was something I would do. That's not who I saw myself as. I wasn't an athlete in high school. I didn't see myself as a marathoner, but I became fascinated with what can I do? You know, if I was carrying these preconceptions with me at an early age and realized that they may not be correct in defining my capacity, what else could I do? So triathlons, ultra distance running, swimming, and basically I've told people that over the decades of doing all this, I'm really only good at one or two things. I'm good at being afraid and I'm good at being uncomfortable. You know, if I'm afraid of something or if it kind of elicits that sort of that fear, that's probably there's something there for me. And so I'm just good at being afraid. I'm good at standing at the edge of the ocean going, yeah, this terrifies me. When do we get in?
Yeah, that's very interesting what you say about being good with being afraid, because what a lot of people don't necessarily realize is that for us to take action, for us to start something, we need to go actually through this, I would say, this stage of anxiety or stress or let's say agitation at least. And sometimes actually translate in terms of fear and people just get blocked by that when in fact this first phase is actually the evidence that we are interested about doing something.
Yes, I would say that fear is probably one of the best tools that an athlete can have. And, you know, we talk about training the brain, and in my world, mindfulness meditation, and it's a matter of recognizing the feeling and recognizing it as a feeling, and non-judgmental awareness of what's going on around you. If there's a shark right underneath you, you don't necessarily need to be afraid. You need to make a good choice of what is my next action. If you find yourself afraid, what is the right action? Not responding to the emotion, but responding to the facts. But fear, you know, physiologically, a heightened sense of, you know, heightened adrenaline, hyper awareness, it actually triggers a lot of things that are very good if you're in a dynamic open water environment like the ocean, or a dynamic endurance challenge, you know, out in the mountains on the trails. It's fear is not the mind killer. Fear can be the motivator if it's channeled and embraced correctly, I think. Would you agree?
Oh, yes, completely. And to your point, it's true that fear is sometimes the result of a lack of awareness, a lack of understanding. So it's all about making ourselves familiar with this feeling of uncomfort. Make the unfamiliar familiar, which doesn't mean actually taking like risks that can kill you. I don't think you guys are doing that, but this is just about making ourselves comfortable with an environment which look risky.
Right, exactly. I think that a lot of people see, you know, YouTube videos or people doing all these things and they go, wow, they must have no fear. And it's a matter of channeling that. And I think that there's also, you know, people have various physiological responses to fear, and certain levels are needed to trigger some people. So some people are less susceptible to lower levels of awareness than someone else might be. But I would tell people, you know, they see some of the stuff I do out in the ocean, I'm like, oh, I spend a lot of time afraid. You know, you don't think that, you know, in Monterey Bay, where I know there are great white sharks, where I know there's stuff out there, that I don't pay attention to. I'm feeling a little trepidation right now, but so
how do you deal with that when you start to swim like that? And I want to talk, of course, about some of the long swims that you have done, like in very extreme environment, like super cold, super hot, swim with sharks. So let's talk about this one, for example, like with sharks. So how do you're aware that there is a potential risk. How do you deal with that? How do you make yourself comfortable in that environment?
I think that the comfort comes from, one, in a lot of long distance marathon swims and a lot of endurance events, you have a team around you. So often there is the athlete that's putting forth the physical effort to reach the finish line or to reach the goal, whether it's a mountaintop or another shore. But then there's a team around you that is providing safety and support. And one of the first things I do is go, look, I'm afraid of certain things, or I don't know about afraid, but I do a risk assessment. What are the risks of being out in the water? We know that there are jellyfish. We know that there is cold water. We know that there are sharks. We know the distance. We know the weather. So how do we then go through and check off ways to minimize that risk to a level that's acceptable? If you look at the U.S. Coast Guard in the United States, they have a GAR test, which is green, amber, and red. You know, if you're going to a go or no go for a rescue or a situation, green means we feel good, it's time to go. Amber means there's a couple of things kind of triggering some stuff, let's reevaluate. Red means, yeah, this is not right. So standing on the beach in Monterey, we've spent weeks and months preparing for the perceived risks and putting the team in place that I know can react to the unexpected, the unplanned. And as you know, from spending time in the ocean, things can happen completely, honestly, unexpected, but things change. It's a dynamic open water environment that you need to always respect. And I think that I work on replacing the fear with respect. I respect the emotion that it causes or may elicit in me and in others. So for Monterey Bay, for that swim, for instance, one of the members of my team was a veteran U.S. Coast Guard rescue swimmer. I know that that's someone who has experience in some of the most challenging conditions and rescue scenarios that anyone could possibly face. I know that whatever happens, what he's going to bring into that situation is a calm state of mind. So he's going to make decisions that are going to keep everyone safe. I also have people with me that are experts on reading the water and the weather, and experts on reading me. My wife has watched me train through so many things in so many different environments. So having someone that can pick up where my brain might leave off as I'm immersed in the effort of the moment, I need someone to be, to steal a phrase from a rock climber, I need someone on belay for me. So yeah. I can take the risk while someone else has it covered.
What you say is very important about the importance of having people around us who can assess, mm-hmm. Who can assess how we feel and who are there for us. Because there is one thing we don't necessarily realize, is that 95% of what we do is governed by our subconscious mind. And we have a certain number of things in our brain that basically kind of like hijack our conscious awareness as soon as a certain number of markers are going to mm-hmm. be passed. Norepinephrine, for example, or noradrenaline, I don't know how you call that in the US, but once it passes actually a certain level, then the brain will say, okay, now I need to be in charge. I need to hijack your consciousness. And this is why a lot of long distance athletes, for example, or let's say people who are starting long distance running or long distance swim, at some point they just give up because this level has been reached. And the brain says, okay, now I take over, even though physically there is nothing wrong with us. And it can happen actually in a lot of circumstances, a lot of different situations. And if you have someone who can monitor that and who can assess the relationship between the physic, the body and the mind, then you can see if something actually is not congruent, something is sounding wrong.
And I think too, I think as I've gotten older, I've looked at my approach and mindset within endurance challenges kind of evolve. Mm. And I'd like to think that it's become, not necessarily when I was younger, it was kind of the application of brute force, you know, that I am going to force my way through whatever came up. And I find that now the phrase that I cringe at the most is when I read an article about, one of my endeavors or someone else's that they conquered the ocean or they conquered the mountain. Whereas my mindset is I'm finding a way to move with it and move through it. I mean, the last thing I would ever say is that I conquered Monterey Bay or I conquered that swim in Alaska. I found a way to work, to marry my capacity physically and mentally with the conditions that were presented to me. It was very much a symbiotic relationship with the environment and my body and my mind, as opposed to conquering it by sheer force of will. And I think that mindset opens up more potential, because if you're just applying brute force, there's a lot of things out there much stronger than us.
Oh yeah, I really like that. I think this is very, very powerful. I really like these words and this approach. And tell me a little bit about mindfulness, because you mentioned by mindfulness earlier. Mm-hmm. Is it something that you have developed recently when you were starting triathlon as a professional, for example? Did you have this mindfulness approach, or is it something that came later?
Well, to be perfectly honest, I started triathlon so long ago, I don't think the phrase mindfulness even existed in the...
Yes, fair enough.
This was before you could Google it and before you had an iPhone app that would tell you and guide you through it. So just that we fully bear our souls and admit to the aging that is, diminishing our VO2 max. But I, if I sound intelligent at any given moment, it's probably because I'm plagiarizing my wife. He is a social scientist PhD who studied brain development in adolescence and specifically looked at mindfulness meditation as a way to positively impact how people building a decision-making tool and a toolbox where you can better respond to highly emotional situations, mm-hmm. whether that's in the environment where you live in an area in a challenged, underserved area, or whether the way I took it in the challenging environment of an endurance setting, an emotionally charged experience on the trails or in the ocean. And so as she did her research, I became fascinated with the potential, because I always recognized that in myself and in others that I worked with, often, like you said, you know, the mind would kind of go, I just can't, this is it. You know, before the body needed to quit, the mind was kind of a controlling factor. And I think that I was always a little bit different. I ran my first marathon when I was 16. Wow. I always had this kind of delayed gratification thing, even hardwired into me as young as I can remember. I did my first Ironman distance triathlon when I was 18. And keep in mind, this was back in 83, 84. There weren't any role models. People were still misspelling the word triathlete. Timex had not developed a watch yet. So I think that I always was kind of in my own head anyway. But what I found when I adopted an ongoing mindfulness meditation, guided mindfulness meditation practice, just a 30-minute session as often as I can, you know, trying to at least a few times a week. But as I sat down for 30 minutes through this guided mindfulness meditation, it allowed me, and I recognize this, whether it was a swim workout doing a mile for time, or whether it was an endurance event in Australia where I felt I was way over my head, I had trained myself to kind of step back from the emotional going, I'm going too fast, or, oh, I'm not going to be able to make it, or, oh, what's going on, and calm that down and just assess, where am I? What's my heart rate, my breathing? How's my shoulder? How's the stroke? What's the current doing? What are the waves doing? What's the temperature? And I think that it's kind of like you know what it takes to run a 15-minute 5K. You need to basically run sub 5-minute miles for 3.1 miles. But knowing what you have to do and have the physiological tools from training to do that, have you built up? Have you maximized your lactate threshold? Have you maximized your VO2 max? Have you developed the muscular endurance to hold that? In my experience, the mind was the same way. I might have had the innate skill to do it, but the right training program allowed me to maximize whatever was already kind of hardwired into me, if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is a very, very interesting message as well, because you can hear a lot of people saying, oh, look, you know what? I don't have a talent to do that. I don't have a talent to do long distance. I don't have the talent to do short distance because I'm not fast enough. Well, actually, this is pretty much an illusion and an excuse, because when through the practice of meditation or mindfulness, you can start observing yourself. You can start observing the environment, and then you can see actually what is the path for you to progress. You can see actually where you need to, how you want to evolve. So, just tell me something. At what point did you start this mindfulness practice? When was that?
The actual practice itself, probably, better part of 8 to 10 years ago.
You started actually the long distance event like much earlier than that.
Much earlier, yeah.
Yeah. So you mentioned that at a very young age, you kind of like embraced a delayed gratification, which is quite a rare trait, to be honest. I mean, moving forward, you're starting this mindfulness practice about 10 years ago. So how did that change your relationship to effort? How did that change your relationship to resilience, maybe?
That's a really good question. I think it changed my relationship in that I was better able to assess and realize my potential. Whereas before, I wasn't as aware of it. I knew that I could possibly do more, but I began to be able to make a more informed assessment of what more I could do. And the other thing that was important was not all of us are going to win Kona. Not all of us are going to qualify for the Olympics. And what it also allowed me to do was give me some peace when I did reach my limit. I mean, not all of us are going to be able to perform really well in 48 degree water. There are physiological limits on what we can do. And I think that as I pushed my own limits and ran into them, especially as I got older, that I may not be as strong or as fit as I was in my 20s, the mindfulness meditation, the approach of what can I do? And having peace with that accomplishment. I think someone asked me once what does success look like? And success to me is peace with any outcome. And I think that the mindfulness meditation helped allow me to find that peace in any sort of outcome.
Mm. Yeah, that's very interesting. And indeed, like me, I do a lot of meditation, and you can actually see the difference when you really practice meditation or practice mindfulness. Because to your point, a lot of people actually see failure as the end of something. Yes. While actually, yes. when you practice meditation or you practice mindfulness, what you do is you start observing that, okay, that's either a dead end or this is mm-hmm. one way that doesn't work.
Right, exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
On the path to getting this point that doesn't work, or on the path to get it to this point of failure, I've learned a lot of other ways to maybe, you know, try another path or try something different. Therefore, I'm opening a new door to myself.
Yeah, and to your point, we were talking about Monterey Bay. Initially, when I did this swim across Monterey Bay, the year before I succeeded in that swim, I failed. Mm. I got pulled out about 8 hours in after having a horrific experience with jellyfish, and it was extremely traumatic. And I was probably one step away from ending up in the hospital. And was that a failure, or did it set me up to approach the next year with an improved mindset as well as improved training? And I think that the perception of what that experience was and what I did with that experience is what really changed for me. And I think that's what you're talking about as well. You know, so what is failure? Yeah.
Yeah. So what you're talking about as well with this swim that you had and you got stung by like a lot of jellyfish. And I think one of your name in Samoa, what was it? Means jellyfish, right?
Yeah. So I spend a lot of time. I've been doing a lot of work in American Samoa in the South Pacific. In fact, the backdrop behind me is the village of Aunu'u. Okay. And I was given a Samoan title, and that is Wila'ua Sami, which is, the English translation is lightning in the ocean, but the kind of slang translation is jellyfish. So without knowing about my past, the Samoans basically named me Chief Jellyfish. So if that doesn't, kind of keep you from developing too much of an ego about being, I'm Chief Jellyfish, the very thing that was kind of the cause of my demise and then actually launched my ocean career has now become my namesake. Yeah.
So how do you, because we talked about resilience, mindfulness definitely help with resilience. Once you get to a project, the end of a project, you realize there are other paths that opens new door to you. When mm-hmm. it comes to handling pain, so this is the experience you had actually with jellyfish.
Right, right.
So how do you deal with pain? Do you tame pain? Do you reject pain? Do you accept, observe pain? And how do you deal with that?
I think that's really good. I don't know. I'd be interested to get your input on this as well. For me, I have always kind of immersed myself in the pain. Even when I was really young, running my first marathon, the pain actually kind of fascinated me. Mm. It motivated me. I wouldn't say I necessarily sought it out, but I became very comfortable with that type of discomfort. In the decades of doing this, I've been through some of the most extremely painful situations I can even imagine. The jellyfish, I couldn't even begin. I mean, there's so many stories, but I liked that feeling. And I think that I work with a lot of people. I do a lot of swimming in cold water. I used to live in Northern California and would swim, year round in Monterey Bay and San Francisco Bay without a wetsuit. So people ask me, how do you get used to it? And I go, well, you do adapt to cold water swimming, and most people can adapt better than they expect. But I think the main differentiator for me, if you look at cold water, is just kind of a type of pain or a type of discomfort. I liked the feeling. That immersion in cold water at 51, 52 degrees, I liked that feeling. I would never say, oh, I don't get cold or I'm not cold. I was cold. I felt the cold water. Anyone who says they don't is lying to you. You do not get your body into 50 degree water and go, it's not cold. If it is, there's something physiologically and mentally wrong with you.
Good. I feel better now.
Yeah, exactly. But I liked the feeling. I knew what my body would do as it would adapt to it. And I enjoyed that process. And I think that that's kind of the same mindset. You know, I remember late in a 100-mile run being just in extreme pain about 65 miles into it, but with 35 more miles to go. I mean, literally thinking, I don't know if I can move my legs anymore. Like every footstep hurts. But then just kind of moving through that and realizing there was something on the other side of it. And whether it's a physiological response in endorphins or your body's natural ability to kind of deaden that sense, yeah, or just kind of having a peaceful sort of relationship with the discomfort and the pain. So I think that's always been my experience, that I liked it. I you know, I don't want to go pound my head against a wall or drive a nail into my hand, but I liked that pain that came from effort.
Yeah, but that's quite interesting. Actually, this is something that I've seen with a lot of elite athletes and people who have an ability to pursue their goal. This is this acceptance of pain. And it's all about the perception that we decide to have about something. You can see pain as a piece of information.
Yes.
When I hear you like talk about pain, you talk about thinking about pain. You have actually like a conscious relationship with this piece of information that is happening in your body. I mean, that's not fake. That's real. You can feel the cold or you can feel the pain, but you kind of like detach yourself from this piece of information instead of being trapped within purely, I would say, a subjective interpretation of this feeling.
Yeah, and I think that's brilliant. I really like the way you kind of phrase that, in that it the pain is an indicator of something. It's either something could be wrong and you need to respond to that, or you need to adjust. And I think that that's exactly it. I mean, and that's that mindfulness meditation, that awareness approach without having an emotional response to it.
Yeah.
My foot really hurts. I'm afraid. I'm never going to be able to finish. This is my A race. I'm not going to be able to do anything. I'm not going to be able to win. I'm not going to be able to qualify for Kona because my foot hurts. No, that's an emotional response to it. What's actually going on? You know, what does that discomfort tell you? If you're on the bike, do you need to adjust your position? Do you need to adjust your cadence? Do you need to adjust your foot strike if you're running?
Yeah.
It can be a very valuable piece of information, and doesn't necessarily mean you're a failure and you're not going to succeed in your goals.
Yes, absolutely. I think this is very true. And I think a lot of people give up as well. And I'd like you to tell me a little bit about, have you ever given up an event, like a sport event?
Yeah, I have. And it's interesting. So I started doing marathon distance swims, and I did I tried to swim across the Catalina Channel, and I had a failed attempt to get across the English Channel. I had really bad conditions, and it was chaos. My crew didn't think it was safe. It just wasn't clicking. It wasn't happening.
Yeah.
And about a year or two later, I was trained and I was out. I was probably 2 hours off of Catalina Island. And I looked over at my wife and I'm like, this is just not right. And I got out of the water, and I think that physically I was fine, but mentally it's just, I didn't want to be there. The event being there didn't feel right. I saw it in her eyes as well. My wife has been involved with this with me for 15 years now, and she has her own amazing family story with connections to the ocean and swimming. She knows me, and when we both look at each other and go, this doesn't feel right, we acknowledge that, and I got out. And I actually have never regretted that. I think what I realized was chasing after and doing these events that really were away from what my core value was, what I really wanted to do. I always tell people that in any either structured event or endurance event or just personal challenge, you need to be prepared for what we call the two W's. And the first W is, why am I here? And that usually hits towards the beginning, like, why am I doing this? Why am I in this? And the second W is, when is this going to be over? As in, later on, when am I done? And you need to be prepared for those two, because the first why is going to determine whether or not you had the fortitude and the focus to keep moving into this, further into this. And the when is this going to be over is a chance to kind of reset your patience and just stick with what's going on in the moment and keep moving towards that finish line or towards that end goal. And I think there have been some times, and there are a lot of times in the water as well, and we even talk about this. It's a safety thing in the ocean with lifeguards and ocean athletes, that when in doubt, don't go out.
Yeah.
And there are times, I've spent enough time in the ocean, I'm sure you have as well. I train ocean lifeguards, so I'm often in dangerous situations because it's what I'm supposed to be doing. But there are times that just the ocean just does not, like, this is not the place to be. And I have turned around on workouts because I'm like, yeah, this is just, it's just not right. I don't know if it's, you know, subconsciously processing weather and changing water conditions and waves, and then factoring in, am I a little fatigued? Am I tired? Could I make a bad decision that would put me in harm's way? But there are times where I've definitely gone, yeah, it's, I need to go do something else today.
Yeah, that's very powerful. And I haven't reflected on that, but what you said about the relationship between giving up or resigning and the relationship between having a very, very clear, what you call your WW, very clear why I'm doing something and when this is going to be over. This is quite important because I believe the, I'm really glad that you say actually, yes, I've given up. Because a lot of people see giving up or failure as the end of it. Mm-hmm. When actually they should embrace that. This is something completely normal. The only people who never give up are the one who never try anything.
But the
very powerful thing that you say that I haven't connected is like, you need to have a good reason to give up. Mm-hmm. You don't want to give up as a result of an excuse you make to yourself. But when you have actually a very strong why, and when you have a very strong sense of when, like, then in that case, when you see that all this stuff actually are not being, you can take actually, I would say, a very conscious, articulated decision to say, okay, now I need to give up because it's not safe or because this is not within my values. But what you say is very powerful. So yeah, it's something that people should reflect on.
Yeah, and really use it as a learning opportunity. And it's interesting to me that, like, one of the swims where I did not quit or give up was one of the ones in which I had a large shark swim underneath me. I was doing a channel swim in Hawaii, and there's a very real physical threat that's 20 or 30 feet right below me, but it felt comfortable. It felt safe. There wasn't an aggressive behavior by the shark. It felt okay. So, you know, I stayed and kept swimming. I swam another 3 hours and finished. And I think that, you know, we all have people that motivate us or can become mentors or guides. And, you know, I mentioned a moment ago, my wife's family's history to swimming. Her father, who passed when she was just 12 years old, was the first person to swim from the Farallon Islands off the coast of California to the mainland, to Bolinas. Mm-hmm. And the Farallons is where they go to research great white sharks. It's probably one of the most daunting swims on the planet. And he swam it in 1967, and that swim wasn't duplicated for 40 years or more. No one finished it. No one did it. And so he had done this amazing thing, and I have newsreel footage of him standing up on the beach and doing an interview right as he gets out of the water. And he's like a superhero at this point. He's done something that no one has ever done. Everyone thought was impossible. And they asked him in the interview, Colonel Evans, did you ever think about quitting? Did you ever think about giving up? And here's someone who could have said, no, never. I was never going to go. I was never going to quit. I knew it was mine. I was going to conquer. And he very, very peacefully and very humbly said, yeah, there was a time early on when my shoulder was hurting that I thought about giving up. And I thought, and that's still, that image and that video clip has stayed with me ever since I first saw it, because I thought it was the most powerful statement of true strength that I'd ever heard.
Okay.
You know, this is someone who could have claimed invincibility based on what he'd just done. And he instead admitted not a weakness, but a soft side that, yes, I had to move through this just like everyone else does. And that continues to be a very powerful moment in watching that and then recognizing that on my own as well. Yeah, there are times when I didn't think I was going to finish, where I didn't think I had what it took. And there are times where I didn't accomplish what I wanted, but that wasn't the end for me.
Yeah, that's very, very interesting. And that reminds me of the work of Brené Brown. I think she's from the US, with linking courage and vulnerability.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a lot of what this is about. There is no courage that can happen if we don't put ourselves in a vulnerable position. And right. Having voices like yours who say, well, yeah, I do give up. Yes, I do have difficulties. I expose myself. That's very powerful, because a lot of people actually don't have this culture and they don't want to feel vulnerable or be vulnerable. And as a result, in fact, they don't do anything. And they don't explore their potential, because, I mean, you're an adventurer, but to me, you're an explorer as well. Like, you're exploring your own potential, which is very, very powerful. Have you ever had any kind of self-doubt?
All the time. Absolutely all the time. And I think that, you know, as we get older, and especially look at the conditions that we're in now with the COVID-19 pandemic, with I personally lost work and have a lot of uncertainty in my life. And I spent the first part of this year and the last part of last year mapping out what we were doing with our foundation, mapping out these new campaigns, mapping out these new projects. And by March 10th, that was gone. I mean, it was gone.
Yeah.
So, you know, I've taken not just the endurance pursuits that I put forward, but just personal life as well. I mean, doubts and everything? Absolutely. And I think that so many of us like you know, we put ourselves out there in podcasts and I do a lot of speaking and a lot of motivational speaking. And I think that I do have doubts. I mean, a lot of times I'm going, I don't know if I have anything to share. You know, here I am just broken by an event or by conditions that have just hammered away at me, and go, you know, and it's okay. And I do feel broken at times, but I also have this wealth of experience, these remember when stories, where I also felt broken. And I realized that, you know, it sounds like a cliche, but you just get back up again. Yep. But it's not always that simple. It's not a matter of popping back up and hitting Apollo Creed one more time and then you win. Sometimes getting back up again isn't in a moment or in a day. It might take a month or a year. I failed to make it across Monterey Bay. It was a year before I came back to that. And there was a lot of doubt and preparation and assessment and personal evaluation before I was able to stand on that beach again a year later.
That's it. So this is really like embracing this self-doubt, because this is just part of a process. This is an opportunity to reflect on ourselves. Evaluate, as you say. That's brilliant.
Yeah, and I think that so many of us, it's too easy these days with social media, and everyone posts, shares their most successful moments, and rarely do we share our most vulnerable ones. But I will tell you that I feel it's important to share. There's a quote from Jacques Cousteau that anyone, and I'm paraphrasing, anyone who has the opportunity to live an extraordinary life has no right to keep it to themselves. And I think that with these extraordinary opportunities that we have to dive into different cultures or communities or oceans or explore trails, that sharing that might open up opportunities for others. And I feel that that is one of the things that is the purpose behind everything that I do now. And, you know, so anyone who goes, oh, you know, you're never afraid going, nope, that's actually the one thing I'm good at. I'm afraid all the time. And there is doubt. And I move through that, but I pay attention to it.
Yeah, that's great. And I would like to just bounce back on what you said about this sentence from Jacques Cousteau. It's actually
as a Frenchman. Yes, exactly.
I just pronounced Jacques Cousteau maybe better than you, but that's the only thing.
I know exactly.
That's the only thing I pronounce better than you so far. So that's okay. So yeah, and that's very powerful, because I believe this is probably one of the reasons why mindfulness, meditation, mental healthness, mental wellness is being so developed, and there is more awareness around that. Because I mean, if you want to put that in perspective, when Jacques Cousteau was doing what he was doing, he didn't have access to the internet. It was much more complicated to travel. It was much more complicated to have access to all these opportunities. And therefore, people probably had a sense that it was harder to explore our potential. But now, with this world, even though there is this COVID situation, everyone has an opportunity to explore our full potential. Just go on the internet. It's easy to do a podcast by yourself. It's easy to connect with interesting, amazing, powerful, inspiring people. So it means we all have this opportunity to tap into what is our potential. And the only way you can really do that is by starting this self-exploration. And what you do with mindfulness, what I do with meditation, I do a lot of hypnotherapy as well, to remove people's limiting belief. That's what people have to do, so they can really like explore their full potential. That would be probably a crime if you don't pass that.
Well, and what's interesting too, for those of us that, you know, compete or take on these daunting tasks, or seemingly daunting tasks, and what I always hate is, like you, I work with a lot of, you know, adult onset swimmers or people that are new to the ocean, everything. And they go, and I hate it when they come to the beach and they go, I just want to swim to the buoy and back. And I know that's nothing. And their next phrase is, I know that's nothing compared to like what you do. You know, you do so much more, but you know, you and I have been doing this for decades. You know, I get up and go swim, and because it's habit for me.
Yeah.
And I also recognize that someone running their first 5K or swimming to the buoy for the first time, that's a significant life event. That has taken a tremendous amount of effort to get to that point. I have spent decades getting myself to the point where what I can do is measured differently by a GPS or something. And I think that people go, oh, well, I'm not really an athlete. I'm like, if you are approaching something with the purpose of becoming better, of determining your potential that is higher than when it is right now, that's an athlete. It doesn't matter whether you're standing on a podium. If your approach to training is, I want to be better, I want to be better than I was the day before, that in my mind defines an athlete in the purest sense.
Oh yeah, I buy that. Yeah, absolutely. 100% agree. And you know, there is a very interesting thing as well, Ian, and your wife will probably back that up. But there is a kind of science behind why people are giving up. And I think this is Andrew Huberman, who is a professor at the University of Stanford, would I love to have on my podcast, by the way. We basically studied that. And what they realize is that people actually give up when the level of norepinephrine reaches a certain level. And the way to offset the level of norepinephrine is to release more dopamine. And the best way to release dopamine is for us to assess the progress that we have made, to prove to ourselves that we are on the right path. As soon as we start doing that, the brain actually releases a lot of dopamine, and that upsets this molecule, but basically at some point when it reaches a certain level, makes us quit. So what you say is very important. Like people telling people that, yeah, if you just swim to the buoy, that's amazing because that's a progress. This is actually starting from zero and getting there, which is in a sense probably harder than swimming like 10K once you know how to swim.
Right, exactly. And I would say one of the best runs I've ever had was running a half marathon, running my sister, after giving birth to her third child, decided to run her first half marathon, like was not a runner. So spent a year becoming a runner and then running, training to run this half marathon. I got the opportunity to run it with her. And it was probably one of the most rewarding runs I've ever had, because I had been part of the incredible progress she had made to seeing herself as a runner and taking this on. And I think what you were talking about, it's success is really how far we've come from where we started. You know, that should really be a defining point of how far have you come to accomplish what you've done.
Yeah, that's brilliant. I will definitely quote you on that. I love it. So let's talk about your projects now, because you're involved in so many things. So maybe just a few words first about what you're doing. Tell us about the different projects you are working on and what your foundation is doing.
You know, I think that when we mentioned Monterey, and Monterey was a pivotal moment for me. I stood up on the shore. I was doing the swim with the Monterey Bay Aquarium and with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's National Marine Sanctuary Program, which is the part of the United States NOAA organization that oversees marine protected areas. And we were sharing with people what was going on in one of the largest marine protected areas, Monterey Bay. And I stood up on that beach after encountering whales and sharks and dolphins and jellyfish and telling stories of what's going on just beyond the breaking waves. And I felt at that moment that life was just not going to be the same. We had press and a film festival crew was there. We were launching this festival, and the stories resonated further afield than I ever could have imagined. And from there, I ended up going to American Samoa, another marine protected area with National Marine Sanctuary Program, and had the opportunity to go down there to do a swim, but then be asked by the governor of American Samoa to help them address coastal safety and coastal conservation area issues within the community, and found myself immersed in this millennial old culture and community of being connected to the ocean and island. And that was really the pivotal motivation to starting our foundation, really kind of stepping away from my life as a corporate executive. And everything that I do centers around the mission that we came up with for that foundation that I live by as well. And that mission statement is to positively impact how we all feel, think, and act towards our oceans and our community.
I love that.
And everything I do, whether it's an endurance event or whether it's an initiative with our foundation, is how are we going to positively impact how people feel, think, and act? And each of those words is in that order for a reason. We want to elicit a positive feeling, positive actions, and get them to think about their relationship to their community and to the ocean. And right now, a key area of work for me is in the area of coastal safety and conservation. I work with NOAA under a cooperative agreement with them through our foundation. And we have a new series called Wave Safe that was kind of groundbreaking in that we took a geographic and demographic approach to what can people do in and around open water environments that are specific to where they are or where they're visiting to stay safe and to keep others safe. And then what we're also working to do is kind of bring together this safety initiative whenever you're near the water to the conservation side of things as well. We looked at this Wave Safe series with NOAA, built it around three things. And the first thing is a philosophy, which is respecting the ocean. Respect the ocean. From a conservation standpoint, from a safety standpoint, we mentioned this earlier as an endurance athlete, respect what you're about to dive into. And that really kind of is what we're building a lot of stuff around. And the threefold approach is respecting the ocean, staying aware at the shore, being aware of what's going on around you. And then a third initiative called Take 10, which is designed to help prevent second victim drownings so that people act responsibly if they see someone else in trouble. We talked earlier about the safety protocols you have for your open water swimming group in Hong Kong. And there are best practices that protect us and protect others and allow us to respond in the event of an emergency, because there are remote parts of this world where there are no lifeguards, and our actions may determine our own well-being and the well-being of others. And so that is kind of the, everything that we're doing right now is built around that. How do we, you know, impact how people feel and act about their communities? How do we build personal empowerment, personal strength, and pass along a little wisdom as well?
Yeah, that's very cool. And it's true that the open water is an amazing, medium, an amazing platform to pass this empowerment. And because people feel usually, I mean, when you haven't done any open water, even though you have been swimming before in a pool, a lot of people feel scared by the environment, by the open water. So just as we were talking about fear, open water is an amazing way to feel empowered. And to just move to a new level, isn't it?
Yeah, and we talked earlier. We said that very few people are neutral about the ocean or open water. And we use a phrase, we talk about dynamic open water, which is more the ocean-focused, larger bodies of water that are impacted by waves and currents. I mean, a really dynamic environment that's in constant motion. And very few people are neutral. They all either really love it, or it elicits, you know, some fear as well, you know, sharks and waves and all this stuff. Or it's like, with me, it's like, I got to be in the water. Like, I miss that salt water spray. I miss that smell and that feel and being in that all the time. But very few people are just neutral. And it's really interesting, too, like we talk about. I mean, we run a program here where we have adults. We have a coached, guarded open water ocean swim, you know, every week. And we have all these, you know, people come down from the city that have never been to the ocean before. They may swim in the pool 4 days a week. And, you know, boxers always talk about, you know, they've always got a great plan until the first punch gets landed. Swimmers always have a great plan until the first wave knocks off their goggles. And then it's like, you know, what do I do next?
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, the lifeguard in me, you know, learns to kind of look at, you know, really confident swimmers and look at their facial response to looking up at the water when they're used to looking down at it. And, you know, what are they going to do next? And you see a lot of deer in headlights with that as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, yeah. But you send them home loving it. And that opens the door for making choices that also help conserve it and protect it.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And tell me something. You have been started so many projects, and I'm just reflecting on that because you have a very strong statement. You have a very strong philosophy that you have developed around these projects. And I can see, I would say, the majority of the people are dreamers. They think mm-hmm. about a project, they dream about it. Eventually, they talk a lot about the project, but they don't do it. So, you are a doer. You do things. So tell me, what is the mental pattern of someone who is doing something? How does that work in your mind when you think about the project?
That's the brilliance. That's the question. That is the question. And recognizing we take these Myers-Briggs personality tests and going, are you a risk taker or where should you best fit? And I was in corporate America. I had a paycheck come to me every 2 weeks and I did this job that was scripted out for me. And, you know, the entrepreneur title was not something, you know, that's a newer thing in the last 10 to 15 years. I'm going to be an entrepreneur. I never thought about that. I think that I was always purpose-driven. Even when I was working for someone else or working for a corporation, I felt that I was driven by a purpose, a sense of reward and what I wanted to accomplish. And I think that through being prepared and always throwing myself into uncomfortable situations, that opened up opportunities. And I think that I, you know, as you as well, that you've started your own initiatives and started your own podcast and started your own companies and forged your own path in Hong Kong. You know, I've kind of done the same thing. And I see a lot of people come to me and go, oh, I want to do that. I want to do that. And I'm like, you have no idea yet the amount of work. It is the why and when. And the when is that it's not going to be over. That you must embrace the process. And I think that it is, it sounds like a cliche, but it is a journey. And I think the doing mindset, for whatever reason, I've always just embraced the challenge. If I used to work as a project manager in the corporate world, I would design and develop and execute plans. If people said, I want to get from A to B, but I have no idea how to do that, I was a guy that found a way. And it was really interesting that when I came into the nonprofit and Ocean Foundation world, it's like I saw a path. You know, I'm like, okay, we need to do this, and this is how we can do it. And a few years ago, the bulk of my work right now is with NOAA and the National Weather Service in these areas of coastal safety. And they came to me and said, would you be willing to join us in this cooperative, you know, arrangement to improve how we message and reach people and change behavior around coastal safety? And I was like, yeah, I mean, this is just a matter of taking everything that I knew about how do we get to be, how do we get there, and how do we layer in all these other experiences. And I find that as an entrepreneur, I pull every day from experiences in the corporate world or in my personal life that you wouldn't think would fit, but they do. They belong there. And I think that, again, it's circling back to standing on the shore. What are you afraid of? And I had a friend ask me, he wanted to start a new job. He was unhappy with what he's been doing for the last several years. And he's like, Bruckner, you've done it. You've went out and did it. And I think that, and you'll recognize this, often if you're facing an oncoming wave, you know, if you're paddling out on a board or a surf ski or swimming, the safest place is to keep moving forward and move through that wave. You duck underneath it. The worst place to be is in that impact zone, frozen by inaction. And once I decide that I'm going out into that ocean, I am going out for a workout or a race, and that first wave is up in front of me, I know that I need to charge towards that wave with as much speed as I can muster, because I know on the other side is going to be the reward that I want, which is going to be this peaceful calm past the crashing, breaking waves that are trying to drive me into the sandbar or the rocks. But you get offshore, that's blue water.
And what you say is very interesting about raising the question, what are you afraid of? Because that's indeed actually the right question. And a lot of people don't dare asking themselves the question. They don't face their fear, because maybe they see that as a sign of weakness. Right. When actually having the clarity to face your fear, as you mentioned, once you know actually what you're afraid of, you can work on it.
Exactly.
And then the second thing you mentioned is that clarity on your purpose. You mentioned the why and the when. Because I see a lot of people not having clarity. They think they know what they want, but when you ask them to articulate what is it they want exactly, what is the outcome that they can think of, then it starts to be very blur. And when you don't have this clarity about why you are doing something like that, why it matters to you, when do you think it's going to happen, what is going to be the path towards this outcome, if you don't have clarity on that, the first obstacle you face and you're out.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, there's often not going to be the perfect time to do this. I mean, sometimes it's just time to go. And that's not going to say, and I started my own private project management firm years ago, and And I left corporate, and I left corporate working with someone else and started my own company before I started the foundation work. I've made mistakes. I mean, there's stuff that I, when I launched the foundation, I would do differently now. Yeah. I wouldn't go back and change anything, but there are specific decisions like, you know, should I have financed this in this way? Should I have partnered with them or partnered with someone else? Should I have been a little bit more careful with this contract? There's all kinds of decisions that, you know, in hindsight, we learn, and we wouldn't, I made a mistake and I would not do the same thing again. But if you're waiting to have some magic amount of money in savings before it's safe to move forward, or if you're waiting for something else, you know what? As soon as you think you're safe, a global pandemic hits and everything goes out the window. So you'd better be just prepared to roll with what's going to hit you.
Yeah, very true. And you have one statement that I would like you to explain a little bit. I think it's passion, strength, vision.
Yeah, that really became the mantra for what we do. We Ocean Positive is our foundation, and the initiatives that we launch, we often refer to as these blue journey initiatives, these movements towards the blue, towards the water, towards this peace. And we wanted to kind of create sort of to consolidate, you know, moving forward with the foundation, we had the mission first. And with the blue journey and what we wanted to instill in others, passion, strength, and vision, which is the passion to care, the strength to act, and the vision to inspire, which means that whatever your endeavor, if you're not passionate about it, you're not going to be able to recognize your potential. You need to be passionate about it. And you need to train to have the strength to act. As a lifeguard, we have requalification standards. If you don't have the strength to run 500, to swim 500 meters in under 10 minutes, you may not have the strength to save someone when it matters. So you can be passionate about being a lifeguard, but you need to have the strength to be able to perform the demands that are going to be put to you. And then the final part of it is what we do for others. And that's the vision to inspire. And do you have the vision to make yourself obsolete or unnecessary or pass it along to someone else? Mm-hmm. When I get the chance to talk to someone younger, whether it's middle school or high school or young adults, I keep thinking, if I had known 20 years earlier what I know now, how much more could I have accomplished? So rather than saying, I'm the expert, it has to be me, what can I open up the door for someone else to do? What can I download that maybe allows someone else to further my mission, further to deliver on my mission to a greater degree than even I can? You know, we have a lot of people in the ocean world. We throw around the word waterman, or the title waterman or water woman. And, you know, it's a marketing tool. You say, oh, he's a true waterman. And in my mind, this is kind of encapsulated or an outgrowth of that, you know, passion, strength, and vision. What we do in the ocean makes us an athlete. What we do for the ocean and for our communities, that's what makes us a waterman or a waterwoman. So with me, and maybe it's because I've gotten old, or I've been beaten down by a few too many waves and jellyfish and sharks, but the reward I find is what can I do? That vision part and that for part is what really gets me up in the morning and keeps me driving forward during the day, whether it's foundation work or my next workout.
Well, thank you. That's very, very inspiring. So we are approaching the end of this podcast.
Oh no!
Yeah, I know. We have. You know what? We have to make another one. But I will ask you a few more questions. I mean, first question is: yeah. Is there one question that you would like someone ask you, or you would like me to ask you?
One question. That's a tough one. You know, it's really, I have had so many questions asked of me, and I think the most important one is, don't ask me about the event that I'm most proud of or where I was the most successful, ask me about when I felt the weakest or what was the biggest challenge. I think that's the question. I mean, you can read and see the successes in video or Facebook or whatever else. But I like connecting with people. I joke that I'm not a people person. I'm a person person. Like I like that. I like exploring and discussing our vulnerabilities and not the bravado. So the questions I think would center on, tell me when you felt the weakest, not when you felt the strongest.
Yeah, that's a great question to ask. Yes, and I think you have already we have already discussed a little bit this vulnerability, this weakness, and I think the follow-up question that I will probably ask if we were talking about the weakness is, what did that do to you? How did you handle that? How did you deal with that? Because a lot of things that I can see is we all have weakness. We all have vulnerability. We all hit walls. People who say they don't hit walls, they are lying to your face.
Yeah. It's but, like, oh, I don't feel the cold, or I it's not cold. Yeah. It's cold. Yeah. It hurts. It's cold. Yeah. If you run the marathon to Sobolev, it's hot, you know, it's yeah.
Exactly. And it's all about how you choose to respond to it. And I can see like people like you who are doing things, people who are really like moving the world forward. They make choices. And I really would like to acknowledge you for that. That's very refreshing. Especially in a world where today we hear all these negative things, we have all these dramas, all this anxiety and this stress. It feels like nothing can be done. That's pretty much the end of the world with the COVID thing. So I would like to acknowledge you really for your passion, for this generosity, working all these projects for other people and to be at the service of other people. That's extremely refreshing. I would like to acknowledge you really for being an inspiration, not only for people who are within this, I would say, water environment, but I mean, what you say, the way you're approaching life, the way you're approaching your projects, the way you're approaching sport is a source of inspiration for a lot of people. And I really hope a lot of people will listen to your words because there is so much to learn from what you say. So I would like to acknowledge you for all that, really.
Thank you.
I would like to finish this podcast with one question. And if you had the opportunity to go back in time and talk to a young version of yourself, at what age would you go back and what would you tell yourself?
You know, I think that when I was 16, I felt really out of place with where I was. And I felt that there was a world out there that I just wasn't seeing, that I felt that things were bigger than that. And I applied for and ended up becoming an exchange student for a year and living in Australia. And, you know, so talking about throwing myself into the other side of the world when there were, I mean, like, we didn't make phone calls. We sent tapes back and forth. I actually wrote letters on paper. That 16-year-old self, you know, made some mistakes, was afraid, was overwhelmed. And I think I would say, you know what? This that you are immersed in right now is going to define the rest of your life. It is going to open up opportunities. It's going to expand your mind and in ways that you cannot imagine, and that you will probably continue to unfold for decades to come. And I think that there were times when I was there where I was just had no idea what I was doing. I was so just overwhelmed. And I think that it would be nice to go back and with a little bit of comfort going, immerse yourself in this. It's going to be okay. And it is going to define the rest of your life.
Well, thank you. That's a very powerful one. That's a great way to end the podcast.
Yeah.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much. And I really encourage everyone to connect with you, be involved with your project, with your foundation. I will post all the links in this podcast and on my Facebook page. So please go and connect with Bruckner. Thank you so much for being with me.
Absolutely. It's been an absolute pleasure. And we'll talk to you again soon.
Absolutely.
Take care.
Cheers, mate.
Cheers, mate.
And if you have enjoyed this episode, please feel free to share with a friend and subscribe. See you in the next episode.